Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Downhill, The Photograph, Sonic the Hedgehog, and Fantasy Island, all for your Valentine's Day weekend. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the not very Valentine's-oriented Transylvania 65000 and Saturday the 14th. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Before I get into the news, which involves, of course, the Oscars, I want to talk about an email I received just this week, and it was what's great about it is it absolutely struck at something that I totally believe in. This is from Michael, and I don't know where he's from. He doesn't identify where he's from, but Michael says, we need to see Johnny Quest on the big screen, maybe a trilogy. Well, hold on. Let's pump the brakes, Michael. Let's get a movie out there first. The genre is somewhere between Indiana Jones and Star Wars. Seeing the cartoon series decades ago fired up fascination for science in me. I'm sure I wasn't the only one. Talk it up, put a bug in someone's ear, twist somebody's arm, let's get him up there. Well, you know, as I'm this hugely influential guy, I'm going to start talking it up now. I might even create a hashtag for this. I got to figure out what it is, so talk to me next week. But yes, when I find an ear that I can put a bug in, I will. When I find an arm I can twist, I will. I have been wanting a Johnny Quest movie for probably decades. I remember watching it as a kid, and then it was on Boomerang. My kids would watch the Boomerang Network, which were like really old cartoons that even the Cartoon Network wouldn't play. And I would show them the old Johnny Quest episodes, and they're just tons of fun. They're kind of like Space Ghosts. There were these series of these fantasy adventure science fiction shows that you really don't get anymore because it wasn't trying to be goofy and silly. It was just about this kid going on adventures with his dad and his possibly gay friend race, but and then they of course had this, you know, really racist Indian sidekick and a little dog named Bandit. But they're fascinating episodes, are lots of fun, and I'm a huge fan of Johnny Quest. I remember reviewing on DVD several years ago the New Adventures of Johnny Quest, which would have been like around 2000 is when those series came out. I remember there was a point where they were talking about maybe having Zac Efron played Johnny Quest. I mean, he's way too old now, but I mean, this was like right after High School Musical. That shows how long I've actually have been talking about a Johnny Quest movie. I would love to see that happen as long as they did it right. I don't want to just see a Johnny Quest movie to be handed to some director who just kind of does their own thing and doesn't worry about the original source material. Yes, I am on board, Michael. I'm ready to put bugs in ears about Johnny Quest. So watch out. I've got bugs. I'm coming for your ears. The next piece of news I really got to hit really quickly is about the Oscars. I'm going to do my Oscar recap right now. I was almost dead on with all of my predictions. Of course, you know, all the actors were sewn up. It was absolutely no surprise with the actors. So I'm not even going to revisit those. I said that Bong Joon-ho was going to win Best Director, and he did. I thought that 1917 was going to win Best Picture, but Parasite pulled that out. And you know, here's the thing. In the last 10 years, do you realize that in the last 10 years, 9 of the winning directors are foreign nationals or born in other countries? I mean, you had like, you know, people like Guillermo del Toro's Mexican and Alejandro Iñárritu's Mexican. And I don't want to hear about this, that the Oscars isn't diverse enough. Yes, maybe your black actors or Latino actors aren't getting the acting nominations that you especially want, but you can't sit there and say that this is just a whole bunch of white men just handing it off to each other, because that certainly did not happen this year and hasn't happened for a decade, really, with the directors. Now, granted, there's a lot more diversity that can be had, but I think this was a big deal. You know, this is the first time you had an international film, that one international film, what was called the foreign language film up until this year, also wins Best Picture. It's the first time a Korean has ever won Best Director. There's also been a bunch of firsts. I think the woman who I don't know how to pronounce her name, but I'm going to try to butcher it. But the woman who did the score for Joker, she's the first woman ever to win for Best Score. Here's the thing. Diversity is not just black and white. It's about Mexicans and Latinos and Islanders. Like, I mean, Taika Waititi. He's Maori. And I don't know if I pronounced that right, but he's not traditionally white either. And he won for best screenplay. So these are names and things that are happening. And so, like I said, it's not just black and white. But it was kind of a low-key ceremony. Nobody was streaking. You didn't have Faye Dunaway out there announcing the wrong Best Picture or anything like that. But the big thing is of course, the other news story that hit was that the Oscars had the lowest ratings ever. And I have to say, it's not because no one's seen the movies, because you can't tell me that in a year that you had Joker and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and 1917 and Little Women all in the Best Picture list, which were mainstream movies that all did well, and then say, well, nobody sees these art house films. You know why no one's watching the Oscars? Because it's a 3-hour ceremony. And it's boring. And there's a billion other options. You don't just have other stations and cable. You've got the entirety of streaming. You've got phones and computers and video game systems. And yet the dinosaur is still sitting there saying, we're going to make this a 3-hour show and everyone's going to watch it because they have to. No, they don't. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer is for the new James Bond flick, No Time to Die. This is the extended version of what was playing at the Super Bowl. But the trailer's out in theaters now. The movie will be out on April 10th.
The world is arming faster than we can respond.
Where's 007?
I need a favor, brother. You're the only one I trust for this.
The world's moved on, Commander Bond.
You were 00?
2 years.
So you're not dead.
Hello, Q. I've missed you.
It's the most valuable asset this country has.
When her secret finds its way out, it'll be the death of you.
What is it?
You don't know what this is.
This makes me very interested in it because it looks like it's going to be a good movie. It looks like it's got all the elements of a James Bond movie. The thing that gives me reservations is they're trying to say, oh, well, look at this big secret in his past. And again, they're overdeveloping the character of James Bond. You can't do that. You can't do 25 movies about the same guy doing the same job and develop the character. Because you'll eventually develop him to the point that he's either not interesting or he's just going to want to settle down. That's my big worry, is that because that's what they did with Spectre. They overdeveloped that character, which they're following based off of Skyfall. And now this one looks like they're going to continue to overdevelop. And I'm like, just reboot James Bond and go back to the one-off shows. The next movie I want to talk about is Spiral, which opens on May 15th.
Whoever did this has another motive. They're targeting cops.
This is gonna go sideways fast.
Someone's out there pulling all the strings.
You wanna play games?
I am kinda down to see more African-American horror movies. Now, granted, Darren Lynn Bousman is directing this. He's the guy who was involved in, like, maybe the second one. So at least they got people from skin in the game for the Saw franchise. But it looks like with Chris Rock producing it, and you're getting Samuel L. Jackson in there, you're starting to edge into what I would say African-American horror movies. And we've already come a huge step into that with, like, the Jordan Peele stuff like Get Out and Us. But I'd like to see more of this, because there could be a real renaissance happening here. Because, first of all, you talk about it as a cultural thing. Black people love horror movies. They really do. And there was a big push for sort of black horror in the 70s. And that was around the same time as blaxploitation and the Shaft movies. But you also got stuff like Blackula and some other movies. I'd like to see some more black horror movies. This is beyond what they had in the 90s. So some of that got really cheesy with, like, Tales in the Hood and Bones. But I think we're watching a revolution starting, and I can't wait to see where this goes. I just hope that the spiral's good. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Photograph and Fantasy Island. And welcome back. back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. Well, when I say jump into the movie reviews, I say that with my tongue firmly in cheek. Because here's the thing. Sometimes when it comes to movie reviews, there are movies that are screened and we get plenty of chances to see them. They're screened early and often, and I see them no problem whatsoever. And then there are movies that are screened, but they're just maybe difficult to get to, or they're a conflicting screening. And then there's movies that there's no screening at all, and then, you know, we all know what that means. But sometimes there are movies that get a screening, and then God decides whether I get to go to this movie or not. And these are the ones that are the biggest struggle, because this one was screened. I'm going to be talking about The Photograph, which is a film that's a romance, and it was screened. They showed it for us, but God decided to dump a massive snow and ice storm on my town the day of that screening, and I was running around, and I only had so much time to get to the theater, and once the snowstorm hit, there were crashes and accidents and slow roads, and there's no way I was going to get to the screening, and I felt terrible because I really pushed to get a spot at this one. So sometimes God intervenes, and that happened. But I mean, I'm still going to talk about The Photograph. Let's just dive into that really quickly. And in this one, a woman is torn by grief at her mother's passing, and so she investigates her mother's life by discovering a secret romance through the photography that was her hobby.
My daughter, I put my love into photographs, pictures, took space in my heart instead of people.
This was supposed to be a date.
It is a date.
I love you.
I love you too.
I just don't understand why she couldn't tell me about her life while she was alive.
Maybe she thought it would help you look at her in another way.
Hey, I'm Michael Block. From the Republic, I'm doing a story about your mom.
How's your article coming?
To be honest, I was a little distracted.
It's so funny because I never know exactly what the political correct term is for this, because people used to call these are the urban romances, which basically means it's black people. That's the problem. It's always with political, and I understand there's a certain level of political correctness that's appropriate. It's called politeness. But then there's other things where you don't know what to refer to it as, because this movie is clearly, it's a movie about black people. It's by black people. I think Will Packer is the producer of it. He produces a whole lot of these dramas and romances for a black audience. So I guess is that what you can say? It's about this woman. She's a black woman who's looking through these old photographs of her mother, who she never had a full relationship with after she had passed, and she finds this 20-year-old romance or 20 or 30-year-old romance. I think it takes place in the '90s, and then she's having a parallel romance at the same time. This is not a romantic comedy. It's a bona fide romance. And there's a big difference. And this is a push for Valentine's Day. And the reason I kind of wanted to see this was because it's one of the few bona fide Valentine's Day type movies. It's actually about a love story. Whereas something like Downhill, which I'll talk about in the next segment, is more like a love story the way A Marriage Story was a love story. But The Photograph, it looks very serious. It looks very somber. It's not a comedy, so it's not a light romance. It's a serious romance. In a lot of ways, or in some ways, it reminds me of If Beale Street Could Talk, at least the marketing of it, the way they're pushing it. And they have very similar soundtracks, very similar music. And of course, it deals with at least a little bit of stuff in the past, whereas Beale Street Can Talk took place many more years in the past. This one's more like in the 90s. But it feels like it's that sort of romance. It's not like Queen and Slim, where they're going off on a Bonnie and Clyde adventure of carnage and criminality. This is meant to be a modern romance for the black crowd. And there is a strong demographic of female African-Americans in this country who support films. And they will vote with their pocketbooks on this sort of thing. That's where a lot of the Tyler Perry, the sort of the gospel play element of Tyler Perry, that really connects to that audience. And you'll see this with romances and, you know, even light romance or thrillers are also things sort of like these, what would essentially be a, you know, black version of a Lifetime movie of the week kind of thriller, where like Taraji P. Henson is being attacked by Michael Ealy or Idris Elba or something like that. So The Photograph, it looks like it's a well-done movie. It looks like I have no interest in it, though. It is not the kind of romance I'm interested in. I prefer romantic comedies than just sort of heavier, drippier romances. I don't know if the movie gels or coalesces because I said I didn't get to see it, but I also can't say it's got a preemptive suck because they showed it to us. They made a point to show it to us. It's just God intervened. So I'm going to leave the review out there and maybe I'll catch it later, either on next week or following weeks if I need to cover something, or maybe I'll talk about it when it hits DVD or Blu-ray. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Fantasy Island. Based on the classic TV series, Blumhouse gives a darker spin to the story about a mysterious island that can seemingly grant wishes.
Good evening. I'm Mr. Rurik. Let me officially welcome you to Fantasy Island.
So, what's your fantasy?
Revenge on a childhood bully.
Just got it. I see it.
Your life is about to change.
I got it. Yeah, I want it.
There is only one fantasy per guest. And you must see your fantasy through, no matter what.
Work. This is not what I meant.
People die here.
What's interesting is I remember growing up watching Fantasy Island. It was Fantasy Island and Love Boat had that 1-2 punch. And there were similar TV shows. I mean, there were very different formulas. You know, the Love Boat where people go on a ship and fall in love. And this Fantasy Island, people go and have these adventures. But they were structured in such a way that they had basically three different storylines with guest stars every week. Now, I remember they rebooted it sometime in the 90s. I think they had Malcolm McDowell and Machen and Mick as the stars of it. And that one, I know they took a darker, different path. I never watched that series, the new version. I remember the old ones with, you know, Hervé Villechaine and Ricardo Montalbán as, you know, Mr. Rourke. This one, it's definitely got a Blumhouse edge to it. Now, they didn't screen this one, so God didn't intervene on this one. The studio intervened and said, nope, we're not going to show this one to you. But this is one of those that we are now starting to see promoted as not from a specific filmmaker or even group of filmmakers, but from a studio. Blumhouse has built up enough of a name as a horror film commodity that they can promote a movie like this and then just say, oh, from Blumhouse. And the last time I ever saw this happen, it was, I think, one of the Deuce Bigelow movies. It said, from the studio that brought you Daddy Daycare or something like that. And you have to question, you'd be like, from the studio that brought you? So you're telling me that a movie that you could take something like from the studio that brought you Jackass, we have the Notebook or something like that. That just to me is an absurd statement because studios should have a diverse selection of movies. And Blumhouse, it's got a good name and a bad name. It's got a good name for being authentically making money. It's a cash cow. They make these small, low budget horror films that end up making bank, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily any good. And while there's some that are good that I've enjoyed, there's also some crap out there. So the fact that they're trying to build it as a Blumhouse movie, it's almost like you're talking about it being a trauma film or a Full Moon movie. And that kind of leaves a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth. Although this movie looks interesting, but it looks like it has nothing to do with the actual feel of the original Fantasy Island, which I would think would be a neat movie. I'd like to see a Fantasy Island done the way they did with the old TV show in the 70s and 80s. I enjoyed that. I remember watching that. I think it was like a Friday night show or Saturday night show. But anyways, they did not screen Fantasy Island, so it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break, and I will review in the next break the movie Downhill and talk about Sonic the Hedgehog. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Downhill. When her husband flees a natural disaster, leaving her and her sons alone, a woman starts to reevaluate her marriage.
It looked like it was gonna kill us.
For a moment.
The kids were screaming because it felt like we were gonna die. And I look over at Pete, and he had grabbed his phone. Pete left us.
Life's a race.
I didn't leave you to be buried.
I'm gonna win.
I ran to get help.
Yes, I'm gonna win.
That's not what happened.
And I choose to survive.
For those who don't know, this is based on a Norwegian film, I believe, called Force Majeure. And having seen the movie, it's funny because it says it's inspired by that movie. But if I recall, it's been a while since I've seen Force Majeure, you know, 5 or 6 years. But if I recall, this is very similar to it. It follows a lot of the same beats. And essentially, it's very much an English language remake. And it's by the guys who wrote The Descendants. One of them was best known as Jim Rash. He played the dean in Community, believe it or not. But anyways, downhill, they take some American actors that are well-known, people like Will Ferrell and Julie Louis-Dreyfus, as the couple, and they tell it as the Americanized version of the story. Now, first of all, you got to realize, you kind of have to know Scandinavian cinema a little bit. Not, you don't have to know it super well, but Scandinavian cinema is very dark and depressing, sometimes very brightly lit. But it's very, at times, depressing. There's a level of depression that happens in Scandinavia that no one likes to talk about because of the winters are so long and the days can get so short when you're up that close to the Arctic Circle. And when you watch the movie, I don't recall thinking that this was particularly a comedy when I saw Force Majeure. And I was talking to another critic and I said, it just didn't feel like a, there were a couple like humorous moments, but it didn't feel like a comedy. He's like, oh, no, I was laughing through the whole thing. And he was like telling me how, like, when he saw Force Majeure at like Fantastic Fest, the audience was laughing it up. You have to understand sort of that brand of humor, just as you would have to understand dry British humor to understand a dry British comedy. And a lot of that Norwegian element, a lot of that Scandinavian storytelling and humor and very dark humor and dry humor is translated into this movie. Now, Americans are going to watch it and understand that it's a comedy because it's got Will Ferrell and Julie Louis-Dreyfus in it. They're going to be like, oh, those are comedic actors. Even though they've both done some serious stuff, they're essentially known to the American public as comedic actors. And that's going to help people respond to it. But overall, I mean, it really felt very similar to the original movie, which is fine because that shows that it certainly is, keeping that essence alive. And that's a good thing. But in the specifics of this movie, I wasn't a huge fan because I wasn't a huge fan of Force Majeure. I know a lot of people loved it. I just thought it was okay. Part of what happens in this movie, and it's because it's a family, but it's not just a husband and wife. It's their kids. And they're on vacation in the Alps. And I don't like any of the characters. And that's always, I don't know how many times I've said this in a movie, I have to like the characters. It's not even that I have to like the characters. It has to be people that I'm interested in. There's movies that are made with people that I don't particularly like, but I find fascinating. Or there's people that I would not want to have in my personal life that are horribly self-destructive. Like James Bond. You know, we talked about James Bond in the first segment. I mean, James Bond is a terrible, you would not want to be friends with James Bond. He's a psychopath, really. He kills people for a living, and he beds any woman he wants, and he's supposed to be completely associated with that. He is not somebody you'd want in your personal life, but he makes a very compelling character on screen. The problem with the characters in this movie is I don't like any of them. Julie Louis-Dreyfus' character is a little bit aloof, and Will Ferrell's character, who is, he's supposed to be the manly man, but the whole thing is he runs away from an avalanche, leaving them to potentially get harmed or killed. But I don't really like him. But even worse, I don't like the kids. The kids are annoying. Here's my problem when I see a movie when you got kids in it, is I always compare it to my own life. And when I watch a movie and you got kids doing something, I'm like, I wouldn't stand for that as a parent. I wouldn't allow somebody to act like that. They're not handling the kids well as parents. The kids are annoying and they're not respectful. They're really poorly written, actually. The characters of the kids are poorly written. So I don't have any sympathy for the kids either. It's not even something where I can say, well, I can relate to what's going on. If I were a kid in that situation, if I remembered when I was a kid, not that my family ever took a skiing trip to the Alps, but if we did, and if you know my family, you know how absurd that would be. But if we did, I wouldn't expect me and my sister to act that way. And so even when they're dealing with their own, it's sort of like that midlife crisis of these two adults going through it at the exact same time and having plenty of temptations. And you can see where that happens because, yes, you spend enough time with somebody, things get normal, things get regular, things get mundane. And you can see when you're in a cool place like that, you know, options could happen and people would want to try different things. But ultimately, you still look at him and saying, well, I just don't like you as a person. I think you're, even how you dealt with, even if you did the right thing in this one situation, you kind of did it with, you know, just kind of as a sleazy person. And I wouldn't have liked that. So that's my problem with this movie. I couldn't relate to the characters because I thought they were all either weak or not pleasant. But still, it has funny moments. If you like these kind of movies, sort of like how A Marriage Story, I didn't like the characters because I thought they were both selfish jerks. And I'm just like, well, they're all acting inappropriately. I can't get behind that. I would hope that I would be better. And I can sit here in an ivory tower, not having run from an avalanche and abandoning my kids and family. I can think that I would try to save them. I would throw my giant body in front of it. And then the snow would just smash around me and I would be like a superhero. But I like to think I'd do that. I don't know if I would. I haven't had a chance yet. You know, on my next vacation, it's very low chance there's going to be any sort of avalanches. Anyways, I'm going to say downhill. I'm going to give it a kind of rocks just to be nice.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic the Supersonic Hedgehog teams up with a buddy from Earth to stop a scientist from using his powers to take over the world.
I'm Sonic, a little ball of super energy in an extremely handsome package. On my planet, people were always after my powers. So I came to yours.
Why are you hiding out in my garage?
They're coming for me! If they steal my power, they could conquer the universe. You have to help me.
No, I don't.
Please, it's life or death.
Whatever this creature is, I'm going to uncover the source of its power.
Yeah, hey.
All right, I didn't see this one. This one wasn't screened. It had some regional screenings, but it didn't make it to my hometown, and I wasn't able to go see it on my own. There's several different things to look at. On the first blanch, I've never played this. I take that back. I played one of the Sonic games once. A friend of mine in college had let me borrow his PlayStation. And I was like, I almost had an epileptic fit. I played a Sonic game for about 5 minutes, and I'm like, that's enough for me. So I never got into playing the games. I know my kids would occasionally watch. There was a cartoon back in the 90s or early 2000s that they get on DVD. But when the first trailer hit and it had such a weird-looking Sonic, I appreciate the fact that the studio went and they made Sonic. They redesigned him. They made him look better. He didn't look creepy and weird. And I think that's great. And I hope that the movie does a little bit of money simply because they did put money into it in reaction to the fan. Now, the takeaway from this is you should have designed him right the first time. You shouldn't have had to throw that much money into R&D of image development and character development in the last minute to make it look right. So you should have done it right the first time. That's a huge lesson to walk away with. But also, I hope that the fans do see it and like it, although it does look like it's going to be a corny little kids movie. I mean, it looks like it's going to be what the Rocky and Bullwinkle movie should have been back in, what, 98 or 99, 20 years ago when that thing came out? Because that movie was just terrible. But it looks like that's what this could be. I don't know how the Sonic fans will react to this because it really does look like a kid's movie. It'd be like if you made a Mario movie. I mean, people have been playing Mario games since I was a kid. But, you know, a Mario movie, not including that awful thing that was made with John Leguizamo and back in the 90s, a real honest-to-goodness Mario movie would probably not stretch through all of its dimensions of age because it's been around for so long. And I think that's the thing Sonic's going to struggle with, is there's going to be a lot of adults who are just going, it's a kid's movie. But it might be fun. I don't know. I do kind of want to see it. Maybe I'll catch it on DVD or Blu-ray when it comes out. But I got to give it a preemptive suck because they didn't show it to me.
It sucks.
That's it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Transylvania 6-5000 and Saturday the 14th.
Transylvania 6-5000.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now that we're done with the movie reviews, let's talk about the box office, or in the subtitle I like to call it, and the fantabulous explanation of one movie about Harley Quinn. This made a lot of news on Monday, and I think it was unfair. Birds of Prey, that movie made $33 million. And you think, oh, that's not bad for a movie in February. Why not? I mean, it's three times as much as Bad Boys for Life made that weekend. Everything other down from 1917 made less than $10 million. Nothing else was really out there to make too much noise. Birds of Prey was really the only wide release. Now, this was reported as a huge bust for Warner Brothers, and it's not good. This is not a good number for a movie like this. The headline that I saw is that it's the worst opening for a DC movie since Jonah Hex. And that's unfair. And here's why. Jonah Hex did not do well at all. Jonah Hex was a huge flop, and it was a flop from the beginning. Jonah Hex came out 10 years ago in the middle of the summer. Its entire worldwide run made less than $11 million. It made less in the entire world than a third of what Birds of Prey won its opening weekend. So don't compare it, because there is no comparison. Birds of Prey made way more than Jonah Hex did. So it's unfair to compare them that way. Now, it's okay to look at it and say, well, it made less than all these other DC movies, even ones that were kind of flops like Justice League or Green Lantern or something like that. That's something that's a little more relatable and understandable. I mean, if you look at Shazam made $53 million its opening weekend last year. And that was good, but it's not like that was hugely bigger than Birds of Prey. Yeah, $20 million more, but it was less than twice that. I mean, it was a significantly higher film. But I don't think that we can declare Birds of Prey dead on arrival just yet. There's another advantage is the fact that it did well internationally. Birds of Prey has made 40-some million overseas for the weekend. So it's about split. It's making a little more overseas. So whatever that American number is, you can see that maybe being the same. I don't know if it's open in all markets overseas. But so, I mean, already right now, it's at a worldwide, it's approaching 100 million worldwide. And the movie itself, yeah, it had a budget of, I don't know, what it was like, 85 million. So it's matching its budget, and then it'll probably end up being profitable. And I'm hearing people say, well, but this movie's going to be, Birds of Prey is going to be profitable. It's still going to be good. It's still a win for women everywhere. But here's the thing. There are some downsides to this. First of all, this is essentially a sequel to Suicide Squad, because they keep the look of Suicide Squad. They keep the character of Suicide Squad. She was introduced in Suicide Squad. They refer to Suicide Squad. In a lot of ways, it's a sequel to a movie that made over $300 million. That's not good. But it's been several years since Suicide Squad came out, and I don't think people remember it that fondly. I think it just was kind of a surprise that it did as well as it did. The other thing that's going against it is this is meant to be a franchise-building thing, and franchise-building thing you want to see grow, and you want to see better numbers than $33 million opening weekend. So while it may end up coming out in the black, this is still a problematic release, and I don't think it has anything to do with Margot Robbie. I think it has more to do with the fact that without her in the movie, the rest of the movie kind of stunk. If they'd stuck to a Harley Quinn movie, I think that would have done better, but they tried to spread it around to all these other characters that really, frankly, nobody cared about. But still, I mean, it did well. I don't know what's going to win this weekend. We'll see. We'll talk about it next week. I don't even have the energy right now to contemplate how much different it's going to be. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The first release I want to talk about is a vintage release. It's Transylvania 65000, and it's got a new Blu-ray out, which is good because generally these older movies, even if you can find them streaming on something like Amazon, I think it's on Amazon Prime for free, the print's not very good. But anyways, in Transylvania 65000, two bumbling journalists are sent to Transylvania to uncover the truth behind the Frankenstein monster.
It began as a routine assignment.
Transylvania.
But beneath the surface...
Transylvania's cute.
It's cute.
...of this happy land, horror awaits them.
They're investigating Frankenstein.
Now they're discovering the truth.
Did you see Dracula?
Yeah, when it first came out.
About the creatures of the night. For a good time, call
Transylvania 65000.
It's good, huh?
This is a movie that it's a spoof, obviously. It's a goof on horror movies. The thing that's so interesting about it to me, I remember trying to watch it back in the 80s and I didn't like it. And it's funny, Leonard Maltin has probably one of his most famous reviews about this, where he played the original Pennsylvania 65000. And at the end of the thing, he speaks over the course and goes, Transylvania 65000, stinks. I'm Leonard Maldon for Entertainment Tonight. It's the shortest review ever. And it's even mentioned to him today. It's one of his most famous reviews. I remember watching it on VHS. I only got about halfway through it, if that. I don't think I ever got through Transylvania 65,000. I watched it at a friend's house a couple of years ago because we were watching a bunch of spoof horror movies. And I remember being completely nonplussed by it. It what's weird is it's got a great cast. It's got Jeff Goldblum and Ed Begley Jr., Carol Kane. You got Gina Davis in there, Jeffrey Jones before he was found out that he was a child pervert. So he had all these people in there who were big names at the time. And part of it is it's directed by Rudy DeLuca. Nobody knows who that is, but everybody who's a fan of films probably has experienced some of what Rudy DeLuca has done. He's best known for working with Mel Brooks. He helped write a lot of the movies. He helped work with Mel Brooks. He was kind of a planning partner on those. And what's interesting about that is when you watch this movie, you see the delivery of Mel Brooks' gags. There's a lot of Mel Brooks-style gags that are kind of, I mean, they were already kind of getting a little bit out of their time in the 80s. Now you watch them and they really don't land. But when you, if you've watched enough Mel Brooks movies, you're like, yeah, I can see these are jokes they use in Young Frankenstein or Blazing Saddles or High Anxiety. There's a lot of delivery that reminds me a lot of High Anxiety. But it's just the difference is Mel Brooks is a way better director than Rudy DeLuca is. And Rudy DeLuca directed this, so you kind of get a Mel Brooks movie without any influence of Mel Brooks. And you show how special Mel Brooks was as a writer-director because he could make a lot of the jokes like this work, and they just kind of fall flat in this movie. It's still fun. It's this weird little element of the 80s with this great cast, and it has funny moments. Oh, you know who else is in it? Michael Richards is in it. Kramer from Seinfeld. Of course, it was before he got the role of Kramer, along with, like, when he was in that movie UHF I talked about last year with Weird Al Yankovic. He was the guy, the janitor who had his own kids show. So, yeah, I still think, it's kind of a fun movie. It's worth checking out if you've never seen it, if you're a fan of horror movies or a fan of cheesy 80s movies. It's worth checking out. So I'm going to have to say Transylvania 65,000 doesn't stink, Leonard Maltin. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Since we talked about Transylvania 65,000, I want to talk about another spoof movie, and I use this as an opportunity to see it because I've never seen it all the way through. And that is Saturday the 14th. A family inherits a haunted house that is being targeted by a mad scientist and a vampire couple.
It gets bad on Friday the 13th, but it gets worse on Saturday the 14th.
The Book of Evil!
Evil? Evil.
We've inherited a house with a curse.
Oh, come on, Mary. You know you don't believe in curses.
Just when you thought it was safe to look at the calendar again, comes Saturday the 14th.
This is a movie I've never seen in my life until I watched it this past week. And I've tried to watch it a couple times. Again, at my friend's house, I watched it when we were watching Transylvania 65,000. I couldn't get through it. I know I tried to get through it another time, and I just couldn't get through it. It's not that good of a movie. It's a spoof. It stars Richard Benjamin, and of course, it's about this family that gets this haunted house, but it is so haphazardly written and so out of place. And one of the funniest elements that I remember about this movie was when it came out, my sister at the time, she'll watch horror movies now because she's like pushing 50, but back then when she was like a kid, this is what, 81 or something like that. So she would have been about 10, 12. She wouldn't see horror movies. And I said, well, we should watch this one. Or we wanted to go see it in the theater, or we wanted to rent it years later on Blockbuster. And she's like, no, it's a scary movie. I go, it's not a scary movie. It's Saturday the 14th. She's like, yes, it is. It's the sequel to Friday the 13th. I go, no, it's not. It's a spoof. And they even say so in the trailers, but it just looked like it was funny. Now, maybe when I was 10, I would have thought it was brilliant. It's not brilliant. It's kind of a mess. Has one or two good gags in it. There was an interest to Transylvania 65,000 for me because I said, oh, this Rudy DeLuca stuff, it's very Mel Brooksy without Mel Brooks's influence. You didn't have that at all. Saturday 14th, it just kind of falls flat. It's not that good of a movie. And I'm sad to say because I'd always wanted to see it. But, you can't win them all. Anyway, Saturday the 14th sucks.
It sucks.
Then that is it. Happy Valentine's Day to everybody. Happy President's Day to everyone. And I will be coming back next week when I'll talk about Call of the Wild and Brahms, The Boy 2. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.